This is a download from BFM 89.9, the business station.
Good afternoon. Welcome to Health and Living with me, T. Shaoik. This is our Health, the Nuts and Bolts series. Today, we're going to be deep diving into the topic of hospitals as a key aspect of service delivery and why it's not simply a case of slinging together bricks and mortar to build them. And we have in the studio with us Dr. Cosby King, public policy specialist, as he always is on this series where we're looking at health systems in Malaysia. Good afternoon, Cosby King. How are you today?
I'm great today. It's a pleasure to be back, Shaoik.
So, when we're talking about service delivery for healthcare, perhaps it would be good to start from a point where we can understand what is the structure that we currently have in place to deliver healthcare services to every single person in Malaysia.
Mm. Well, Malaysia's healthcare system can be divided into the public and private systems. In general, we've got more hospitals in the private side, but more clinics in the government side, in the public side. Mm-hmm. Well, let me give some numbers just for fun. We've got 144 government hospitals versus 200 private hospitals. So 60% of all the hospitals in Malaysia are private for-profit institutions. Mm-hmm. On the clinic side of things, the Malaysian government operates something around 2,900 clinics. They are in the public sector, 2,900 clinics versus about 7,000 clinics in the private sector. Well, actually, now it looks like when I recite those numbers, both hospitals and clinics appear to be predominant in the private side.
Mm-hmm. Okay. When we are talking about these kinds of facilities, could you break down also at what level of the levels of the community they are providing services to?
Well, let's talk about the public side. Well, to speak about the hospitals and clinics in Malaysia actually requires a recitation of some numbers, mm-hmm. actually, and we'll start off with the public side maybe. We have 144 government hospitals, and we can classify them into three groups of hospitals. The first one would be the district hospitals. These are small, generally without a specialist, operated by a medical officer only. And I'll give some examples. Greek Hospital, for example, Hospital Parit Bunta, for example, would be an example of a district hospital. Then we'll have a general hospital, generally with a specialist in place, usually with multiple disciplines. For example, a state hospital like Ipoh Hospital or Taiping Hospital, for example. Then thirdly, we've got the tertiary care or even quaternary care hospitals like the GHKL, General Hospital Kuala Lumpur, University Malaya Medical Centre, and larger centres, for example, like Hospital University Kebangsaan Malaysia or Chancellor Tunku Mukris these days. Mm. That's primary. You can say that's secondary and tertiary care. In the government side, we've also got primary care, a network of about 1,000 clinics, clinic kesehatan they're called, and supported by another 1,000 or so clinic desa. It is often said that no Malaysian is further than 5 kilometres from a government health facility. And this was because since the 1960s and 70s, we've been very conscientious in building a network of clinics and hospitals around Malaysia. So that's on the public side of things.
And private, do we need to make much distinction there? It's mostly it's the private hospitals and private GP clinics. Is mm-hmm. that right?
That's right. Mm. Both these sets of hospitals and clinics in the private side, they're governed by a law called the Private Healthcare Facilities and Services Act, PHFSA. We've got approximately 200 private hospitals in Malaysia, and they range from the really big ones, for example, Sunway Medical Centre or Island Hospital in Penang, to some smaller ones with what we can call them almost maternity homes that they might only have 10 or 20 beds. If you count all those in, right, we may have actually about 300 or 400 institutions, private medical institutions that are for-profit and allow overnight admissions.
Mm.
By most counts, there are 7,000 GPs in Malaysia. And the 7,000 GPs in Malaysia, they operate largely as, well, we call them standalone GPs or sometimes called shop-lock practices. Mm. And there are 7,000 of them. There are some GP chains in Malaysia ranging from two or three clinics all the way up to about 100 to 130 clinics as a chain, for example. And they are owned by various people. Sometimes they are doctor-owned in the case of the general practitioner practices, GP practices, group practices, we call them, and owned by private capital and investment firms and so on and so forth, if they are private hospitals.
Okay. And, if you say that no Malaysian should be more than 5 kilometres away from a healthcare facility, that's the standard that you mentioned earlier, right? Mm-hmm. So if we really break down in terms of geographical spread and urban-rural, for instance, right, how does the distribution of our healthcare facilities look like and where are the gaps?
The quick answer to this one is predominantly in the west coast of Peninsular Malaysia. With the east coast of Peninsular Malaysia, the states of Kelantan, Terengganu, Pahang, and also the Borneo states, Sabah and Sarawak, we will see that the density of hospitals and clinics would be lower. That we do have published statistics about the density of number of hospitals per population, beds per population, doctors per population, and nurses per population, and the list goes on and on. And on almost all these metrics, the preponderance of resources on the west coast of Peninsular Malaysia is quite high. Well, obviously, the population is higher, this is true, and there's urbanization also true, but on a per capita basis, I think these are the there is some geographic distribution problems as well. The second problem is something you've identified as well. There's an urban-rural distribution problem. And the third one is the private sector, understandably congregating on the west coast of Peninsular Malaysia.
Mm. Because if you say that we have 1,000 klinik kesihatan, 1,000 klinik desa, and therefore that accounts for the availability and access to healthcare services, but when you look at the need for specialist care, for instance, then I think that's where you'd see the gap.
This is true. This is true, Sherik. True for a number of reasons, and maybe I'll elaborate on that. Let's assume somebody has a cancer and needs an oncologist. And that oncologist, for a hematology case, for example, a blood cancer like leukemia and lymphoma, Hospital Ampang is one of the premier centres for hematology in Malaysia. Well, we do have hematologists in many centres, many hospitals, public side in Malaysia, and I think that's great. But for some cancers, you have to come to Ampang. So one might imagine that a patient who is in Kara, in Pahang, for example, will have to travel to Ampang to receive the treatment as well. This is one, say, observation. It could be a problem, really. So what the government does to try to fix the problem is a few things. Number one, they have a visiting hematologist, or a hematologist is just an example. Sometimes they have a visiting neurosurgeon, a visiting pediatrician, respiratory physician, and so on and so forth. They'll visit a particular hospital. For example, Taiping Hospital would support Greek Hospital, and so on and so forth. The second thing of what they do is to provide, through some government mechanisms, a transport allowance for the patient to attend clinics in places which are much further away from their, well, homes.
Okay. And I want to pick up on the point you said about, one of the metrics used is also beds per population. So how do we fare in that regard? And what is what do we get by knowing how many beds we have per population? How do we make sense of that in terms of our ability to access services?
When we say beds per population, we actually mean hospital beds for acute patients who have to be warded overnight. And when I say acute, usually it's a condition that comes up very, very emergently. There are also chronic cases, chronic in the sense that the diseases have been long-standing, who also might require admission. That's what I mean by a hospital bed. In general terms, hospital beds are good. But let me provide the flip side before I go on. The flip side is that if we build a hospital inevitably, and stuff it with bids, inevitably there would be a need for us to justify that particular investment. This is particularly true in the private sector and also in the government sector in a sense of something called the bed occupancy rate. Mm-hmm. In general, the BOR or bed occupancy rate in government hospitals in Malaysia is somewhere between 65 to 75%. This isn't a published statistics. However, anecdotal evidence and newspaper reports and the lived experience of the rakyat appear to show that that there's overcrowding in the wards, people are spilling into the corridors, they're sleeping on camp beds, and I think that's also a challenge. So back to your question, shall we? Your question is, what about the distribution of beds and why is it beneficial? Mm. Firstly, bids are beneficial and useful whenever you truly need them, although we must be mindful that de-hospitalizing care is important. And indeed, in the European Union, the bids per population ratio has actually dropped in recent years because they've shifted care away from the hospital towards the community. It's called de-hospitalization, de-medicalization. There are some advantages over there. For example, lower costs, number one. Number two, we rely on the community to provide care that is more comfortable for the patient, also safer for the patient. If you're staying in a hospital for a long period of time, you're more likely to catch an infection.
That's right.
So let's go back to the bed-to-population ratio. It is true that in Sabah and Sarawak, for example, and recently I've been to both the states and I've had a look at some of the hospitals over there, we do need a few more hospital beds, especially for the interior hospitals in Sabah and Sarawak.
Okay, we are doing our Health, the Nuts and Bolts series today. And today we're looking at hospitals as a key aspect of the delivery of healthcare services. In the studio with me, Dr. Koswee King, public policy specialist. When we come back from the break, I'm going to follow up on that point about community-based care because that is a big part of service delivery. And where's Malaysia in terms of that? So stay tuned. You are listening to BFM 89.9. Welcome back to Health and Living. I'm T. Xiao-Ik. In the studio with me, Dr. Koswee King, Senior Fellow for Health Systems and Policies, University of Malaya. This is our Health, the Nuts and Bolts series. And today we are exploring hospitals the role of hospital in the entire health system and not just as a physical space for doctors and nurses together, but in how the hospitals are planned, managed, how they deliver services in order to ensure good health care for every single Malaysian. Before the break, Swee King, you talked about this move towards de-hospitalizing care because we were talking about something like beds per population. So while we need the hospital beds to provide the care for patients, what can we do to move towards community-based care? I know that's probably a whole other topic that you need to come in for, but where are we if we're talking about community-based care as one aspect of service delivery?
Shall we? The short answer is we're not where we should be, even for a country, even for many countries around the world that are talking about community-based care but not really moving towards community-based care, Malaysia is still far behind. And here are a few reasons why we're far behind. The first one is we do have to catch up on a bed-to-population ratio. So let me just be clear about that and then we can set that argument aside. Malaysia at the moment has got 40,000 government beds and 20,000 private beds. These are approximate numbers just for us to anchor the conversation.
40,000 government beds?
Correct, and 20,000 private beds.
Okay.
And these are all for hospital acute emergency care. Mm-hmm. From a bed per population ratio perspective, Malaysia still lags behind our European counterparts. So we have to catch up in a sense. But let's leave that one aside to say that, yep, we do have to catch up and build more hospitals and have more beds. But when do we stop building hospitals? And when do we start building community-based medicine? If the whole world is already moving towards community-based medicine and de-hospitalizing, there is this great opportunity for us to leapfrog. Meaning, we don't follow the trajectory that has been set by other countries, but rather we can anticipate the future and leapfrog. So here are some things that we can do for community-based medicine. The first one is to ring fence some portion of our development budget within the Ministry of Health. And every year, the Ministry of Health receives between 2 to 3 billion ringgit in terms of development. This is for building of new facilities, upkeep, maintenance, and so on. But to ring fence a certain portion of it towards community health, or rather community-based care, not community health. The second thing that we can do is to embed the PHFSA or elements of the Private Healthcare Facilities and Services Act into what I'm calling the Malaysian Aging Master Plan. And often, community-based care is part and parcel of aged care. As a society ages, obviously, we can't keep them all in hospitals, and we need to find some way for us to move them as in the citizens who require non-hospital care into the community. So PHFSA could be married or merged, or elements of it could reference the Malaysian Aging Master Plan, which is something that's currently worked on by various parts of University of Malaya, EPF, various ministries and agencies in Malaysia as well. Building on that, I offer a third thought. Well, let's go back to the first two. Firstly, a ring-fence budget for community-based care. Secondly, marrying PHFSA with Malaysian Aging Master Plan. Thirdly, providing enough incentives for private for-profit sectors to build more nursing homes, community care hospitals, step-down facilities, patient-centered medical homes, which is a concept from the United States. Whatever you call it, and in whatever format it is, the private sector needs to be involved. Mm-hmm. Fourthly, the CSOs, community civil society organizations and NGOs, will have to be involved in this particular game as well. So these are the four things that we can do to prepare ourselves to leapfrog into the future.
Mm. So coming back to hospitals, that's where the acute need is for now. It's not just about beds. It's about adequate staff, equipment, to say the least, some of the things that's needed to make a hospital work to support patients. So in terms of functioning hospitals, where do we stand in terms of being able to fulfill the healthcare needs of the population?
I think Malaysia does very well in terms of a functioning hospital. Well, aside from hospitals that go on fire, for example, in Johor Bahru recently.
Yeah, the problem is that we tend to hear of those, and I suppose it's the way the mindset works, right? You hear a case like that and you think, my goodness, our hospitals are in terrible state. Mm-hmm. So really, what's the bigger picture here?
The bigger picture is that our hospitals are in pretty good shape. In fact, some clinic kesihatan, those community clinics that we have, if we expand the question a little bit, have been anecdotally told to many other people from outside of Malaysia that they resemble hospitals in other countries. Mm. So imagine that a clinic in Malaysia resembles a hospital in other countries. Of course, you know, we can always spend more money in upkeep and maintenance and a fresh coat of paint every few years and better maintenance and upkeep and so on. And all that is very true. But in general terms, I think our hospitals are in pretty good shape, and they do deliver a sophisticated level of care for Malaysia.
Okay. So what kind of metrics can we use to measure the quality of services provided by a hospital?
Mm-hmm. So there'll be three groups of metrics, and each of them will have their own, say, sub-metrics, shall we say. Mm-hmm. The first one would be the outcomes measurement. And this is important to say, when we say the hospital, we also talk about the staffing inside the hospital, the quality of care, what is the infection rates, and so on and so forth. Mm-hmm. So that's one bucket, which is the outcomes. The second bucket would be the user satisfaction. And this is a perceptions game, shall we? Mm-hmm. For example, are you waiting a reasonable and appropriate amount of time to see a specialist, to obtain your medicines and so on? Do you feel like you're cared for by your doctor? Do you feel like your doctor has explained things to you in a way that respects your autonomy? Mm-hmm. So these are questions and sub-metrics that could be used, but obviously they are a little subjective.
Mm.
The third one is whether or not the hospital meets financial metrics. For example, is efficient in managing the financial resources that are provided to the hospital, for example, not over or under budget.
Mm-hmm.
And this one comes with the concept of capitation. Capitation means if, say, Hospital X treats 150,000 people per year, then Hospital X will only get X ringgit per year to spend, and they must spend it in a way that's financially efficient.
Mm.
So these are three metrics. But there'll be other, if you're talking about the physical structure of the hospital itself and divorced from patients and doctors, then there'll be a separate set of metrics. For example, the electricity consumption, the number of surgeries that are performed, including whether or not there's this thing called an autoclave machine, right? Which disinfects.
Sterilizes
the equipment that is used by the hospital. And sometimes we run audits on the sterilization unit and whether or not the sterilization unit meets the specifications that we want from them. Okay. So this is more for the mechanical functioning of the hospital.
Okay. So let's go to outcomes. There are a lot of sub-metrics that would come in there, but perhaps we can look at patient-related outcomes for the purpose of our listeners. I think that's the key on their mind. What kind of patient-related outcomes are we looking at? What kind of standards are we trying to achieve?
So here, I will probably take us away from the hospital itself and center it on the patient. And when you ask the patient, one of the first few things that in their lived experience as they go through a doctor is whether or not the symptom goes away. And that, so you can come to a hospital for a variety of symptoms. I'm short of breath, I've got a pain in my left knee, and so on and so forth. A good hallmark for whether or not a hospital / a health system / a doctor in that consultation one-on-one was good and effective is whether or not the symptom goes away. The second question that we can ask the patient is something that we call HRQOL, or health-related quality of life. Mm-hmm. And in that health-related quality of life questionnaire, there are a few, I think it's 20 or 30 questions. Well, there's another questionnaire called the SF36, I think. Mm-hmm. So it's short form 36, and it asks you 36 questions about how you feel as a result of that treatment consultation. So that's two sets already. Firstly, a very objective question, really, of has the symptom gone away? Secondly, various tools and instruments have been developed to look at the patient's quality of life.
Are these kinds of feedback mechanisms made routine? Because I'm just thinking of personal experiences of visiting healthcare facilities, including government ones, and I've not experienced having it formally part of the process.
Well, in ideal situations, it should be. But we live in a less than ideal world in any health system, frankly, in any country as well. So in the ideal situation, a doctor has an almost unlimited amount of time with you, will be able to ask you various probing questions, open questions, and entertain the biopsychosocial elements of your disease, because the doctor has only a limited amount of time. Usually it's the bio part rather than the psycho and social parts of the disease that a doctor has time to speak with you about.
Yeah, I mean, I'm thinking if you have a short form of 36 questions to get through. That's probably longer than the actual consultation.
That's very true. That's very true. Anecdotally, some doctors in government hospitals in Malaysia only spend between 5 to 12 minutes with a patient.
Let's look a little bit at staffing of hospitals and what kinds of standards are in place. I'm interested to know what the Ministry of Health, what kind of plans they have in relation to capacity building in terms of staffing.
Well, this goes away from hospitals again and the physical structure, at least, of a hospital and towards human capital. The Ministry of Health has 270,000 people right now. This is plus and minus, give and take. And we might argue this is too many or too little, but then we'll have to look at the Auditor General's report that says that public health facilities are generally understaffed. You asked a question, Sherwick, about what sort of capacity building plans that they have, and I'll point to two divisions or departments are inside the Ministry of Health that does human capital planning. The first one is within the planning division. There is a unit for human resources for health, or HRH. And the second one is the HR department. And the HR department works closely with Ministry of Health and JPA to ensure that enough posts are created and there is appropriately distributed and assigned and so on. So the what the HRH team within the planning division does is that they use a World Health Organization tool called Workload Indicators for Staffing Needs, WISN. By using WISN and using the disease profile, the number of populations that hospital typing, for example, will need to serve, then we can budget for how many people we need and what is the skills ratio, which is also important. How many doctors and nurses and pharmacists and dentists will be required to support that population? They do it bottoms up using the model that has been developed by World Health Organization, and they come up with a 10-year master plan.
Mm. And user satisfaction was another main metric that you brought up. And as you said, in many cases, that could be very subjective. And also, though, that's one of the main bugbears, I think, that the Malaysian public has when it comes to the public healthcare sector as well. Perhaps we can explore this aspect a little bit. And are we, is our view of the Malaysian government hospitals skewed by the handful of media reports that we read about long waiting times and the quality of care?
It's possible that it's skewed, Shaoika. In fact, if we look at the media landscape generally in any country regarding any issue, there is inevitably a vocal minority and a silent majority. And a silent majority is generally, shall we say, happy, if I can use the label happy, with the services that are provided by the government. We as in the Malaysian government, and I don't represent the Malaysian government, by the way, so the Malaysian government generally does not conduct an exit interview for a patient who's left the clinic, for example. We don't do this routinely for obvious reasons, no manpower, staffing, resources, and so on. But we rely on two things for feedback from the users. The first one is, well, maybe I can use the word complaints or concerns that are voiced out in the media in various formats. And these concerns are usually very stridently provided.
Mm-hmm.
The second one is periodically, as in every 3 to 5 years or so, we run something called the National Health and Morbidity Survey, NHMS. In NHMS, it actually shows a few very interesting results. Can I share them with you? At a very high level, obviously. The first one is public and private. Malaysians think that the outcomes are better in public versus private.
Mm.
Secondly, obviously, in the private sector, Malaysians think that waiting times are short and you can have physician choice. And that's what they like about it.
Okay.
What they don't like about it, obviously, cost.
Yeah.
What they don't like about government institutions, obviously the waiting time, and you can't see the patients. You can't choose your doctors, I apologize. But what they really like about it is that the access is good, as in you can access literally any physical health facility very, very easily, and it's so cheap. The final thing that they like about the government service is that they perceive that the government doctors are more caring.
Mm.
So not very unusual, shall we say, sentiments expressed by the public as it relates to the public facilities versus the private facilities.
Okay. And speaking of public and private, how are our public and private services integrated in this two-tier system that we have? Are we able to achieve fair distribution of healthcare services? And are we also seeing issues where resources might be duplicated or there are gaps because of that public and private breakdown?
Mm, absolutely. The public and private systems are not integrated in Malaysia. Well, not integrated to a meaningful degree. Of course, there will be patches and outliers that will prove the exceptions that prove the rules, so to speak. So they're not integrated. Then, because they're not integrated, there is a lot of duplication. Here's a fun fact. Malaysia, the Klang Valley, not even Malaysia, at one point has got more CT scans than the whole of Australia combined. And that's the example. An example of inefficiency, because the private sector just bought CT scanners, and I think they should, because they're competing with one another. So prices came down eventually, which is all great news. But here's a fact. The Klang Valley had got more CT scanners than all of Australia combined at one point. So there's a lot of integration. And then to the third part of your question, which is about whether or not the government and private sector could talk to each other to ensure that there's a seamless transfer of patients, so to speak. Unfortunately, this is not taking place for a couple of reasons. In general terms, the government might see the private sector as a competition and not as a partner. And I speak of this in very, very broad terms. I think many countries around the world are also not integrating and collaborating with the private sector well enough, despite professing that the private sector is this great, wonderful creature that we all love.
Mm.
The second thing is none of this is anchored by electronic health records. So portability of data is a problem. If I choose, as is my freedom, to go into the public side and then go into the private side and then move to another hospital, that, by the way, has got some very strong disadvantages, and I don't generally recommend doctor shopping because you really should find a doctor you trust and stick with that doctor as long as you can. But let's assume that I want to move for any reason. The portability of the data is not yet anchored under any meaningful electronic health records, despite a lot of talk towards that end, which makes it difficult for us to still integrate.
Okay. We are looking at the issue of hospitals as a key building block in a health system. And this is our Health, the Nuts and Bolts series, where we explore all the different aspects of how a health system in a country works. And as always, joining me is Dr. Kosui King, Senior Fellow for Health Systems and Policies from University of Malaya. And after the break, we'll just touch on a few more issues related to service delivery and the management of hospitals. You are listening to The Bigger Picture, BFM 89.9. Good afternoon. Welcome back to Health and Living. I'm T. Xiao Ik. In the studio with me, Dr. Kosui King, Public Policy Specialist. This is our Health, the Nuts and Bolts series, and today we are talking about hospitals. Before the break, I was asking you, Sui King, about, you know, this two-tier healthcare system that we have, where you have public healthcare and private hospitals and clinics existing together, and where we're seeing duplication and fragmentation of resources and not ideal transition or sharing between the public and private sector. And do you think that the government should be looking at stepping away from its role as a provider of healthcare services and focusing on other roles, for example, being a regulator or investing in building up the systems that are needed to reach people?
There are two parts to the question, if I may. The first one is whether or not the government should step away from providing healthcare. And secondly, what is the optimal role of governments in providing healthcare? To answer the first one is to say the governments around the world, including Malaysia, cannot ever step away from directly providing healthcare. So there should always be a Malaysian public hospital run by the government, for example, for the rural areas or for people who are completely underprivileged and underserved, the B40s, Orang Aslis, and so on and so forth. This is because in no country in the world can the private sector, for-profit sector be we can depend on them really to go into the rural areas and to serve the completely marginalized. So there will always remain a role for a government, in this case Malaysia, to deliver healthcare and operate a hospital. But then this builds on to the second thought, which many people have spoken about in recent years. The Ministry of Health Malaysia in 1960 was a very small entity. Today it's a very large entity. In large entities, there will inevitably be the problems of management and administration and governance of 270,000 people, 144 hospitals, etc. There needs to be a deconflict within the Ministry of Health. Today, they are playing three or four roles simultaneously, and these roles put them into conflicts of interest within each other. Mm. The first role is that the Ministry of Health is a provider. We operate hospitals. Mm-hmm. The second role is that the Ministry of Health is a regulator through the National Pharmaceutical Regulatory Agency, for example, the Medical Council, for example. The third role is that the Ministry of Health is actually a payer. Well, we're not really a payer, but we receive money from the Treasury, for example, and then we pay pharmaceuticals, we pay various organizations and companies to maintain the hospitals that we have. So these are the three roles already. Let me add a fourth one. This is not directly within the Ministry of Health, but for Malaysia's entire federal government that we're an investor to, through Khazanah and through EPF, for example, who holds stakes in various hospital chains. So there are 3.5 roles that we can't play simultaneously without coming into conflict with one another. Therefore, the Ministry of Health needs to have a debate that's actually long overdue about what sort of role, what's the optimum role for the Ministry of Health in Malaysia's health system. If they want to provide, great, but separate the provider function from the regulator function. Mm. If they want to pay, great, but separate the paying function from the provider function. And if they want to invest, that's also great, but appropriately ring-fence it, maybe a blind trust fund or have a really safe accounting and governance standards to make sure that we don't make decisions that indirectly benefit the government.
And within the issue of just looking at government hospitals alone, how do we fare in terms of the management practices? And, you know, this long-standing debate as well about should hospitals be managed by administrators or should we turn doctors into hospital administrators, you know? And are our hospitals at a level where they can compete with the private hospitals in terms of their management practices?
It's probably unlikely that a government hospital will be able to compete against a private hospital. At least this goes to myth. However, when we look at the numbers, right, with 51%, all, the total Ministry of Health combined spends only 51% of the total budget for all of Malaysia. So we just spend a little more than half, but we treat 60 to 70% of the patients.
Mm-hmm.
That is efficiency. Of course, the private sector spends more per patient. I totally understand that. But the point, if we're just looking and saying that the private sector is efficient and they know how to allocate resources appropriately, then we might argue that that's actually a myth because government hospitals use 51% of the funds and treats 70% of the patients. So it is possible that government hospitals can compete with the private sector. But let's go back to the first few parts of your questions. It's helpful to understand how hospital directors are selected at the moment. I don't have any published information about this, but let's use some anecdotes. Yeah? The anecdotes in my conversations with a few people is that, unsurprisingly, hospital directors are selected based on who's most senior and who you know, rather than who's the most qualified to become a hospital administrator. Then it begs a second question. Even assuming that the person is senior and therefore wiser and more experienced, and I think that's a great qualification, perhaps this person needs to consider a master's in healthcare administration or some working experience in how to manage a hospital. Then thirdly, there needs to be a criteria, a set and prescribed criteria for how you can become a hospital director and the minimum, say, qualifications, either academic or professional qualifications that you need to become a hospital administrator. And I might throw one just right off the bat. Accounting training or financial management training. Completely missing from a doctor's arsenal of weapons in order to manage a hospital. And yet, doctors are frequently relied upon to become hospital administrators, well, simply because we're doctors.
Yes. And having to manage financial, like you said, being efficient in managing the resources that's given to you. And on the note of resources, and earlier you had mentioned that we are lacking in terms of the electronic health records that would ensure sort of that seamless movement of patients no matter which healthcare facility you're going to. What is the role for this kind of digitization of patient records and moving into this electronic infrastructure in terms of enhancing our service delivery?
It will absolutely enhance our service deliveries in a few ways. It's also got some, it's a double-edged sword with some disadvantages. I'll get to that in a while. You know, a couple of days ago, I read an article that says, here's a solution for 9 million pages of documents. So that's apparently the average number of pages for one hospital of a 500-bedder hospital, for example. 9 million pages of patients past, present, and various disciplines and so on. So the efficiency gains of, say, searchability, indexing, retrieval, and so on and so forth of electronics, electronic data management would be definitely number one. The second advantage of an electronic health system is the portability of it. It gives patients the choice to move from one hospital to another. In some imagined future, 10 or 15 years from now, when Malaysia has got multiple hospitals and they compete with one another on price and outcomes, and patients can shop for price and outcomes, that kind of portability is very important. I'll give one example from the telecommunications industry. You wanted to move from telco A to telco B. Previously, you couldn't port your number. Mm-hmm. Now you can.
Yeah.
And this is something that we should be able to do for the healthcare industry as well. And then thirdly, and finally, is to use big data in managing, well, new diseases and looking at trends and looking at statistics and so on. And that can be enabled by electronic health records. It comes with one big drawback. The big, aside from privacy, which is important, and data storage also important, it comes with a big drawback that we don't want to draw doctors away from the patient's bedside to the computer terminal. Somebody has to key in that information.
Mm.
At the moment, we're getting hospital attendants or medical assistants or paramedics to key in that information. By and large, this is happening. And of course, you might say quality, accuracy, and so on and so forth. And I think that's a good point. But any introduction of electronic health records needs to be mindful that we don't want to draw the doctor away from the bedside towards the computer terminal.
But do we have the operational capacity to do this? Almost migrating, first of all, the existing data, and to have the kind of systems that we need to maintain and continue with this?
The technology exists at the moment. Let me give two examples. The first one is a solution in a box, where many hospitals in Malaysia, private hospitals in Malaysia, have, and even GP group practices have got an electronic health record, but they're only limited to, for example, 20 clinics and 5 hospitals. I'm just inventing the numbers. And these solutions are provided by third-party software developers. They could come from Singapore or the Philippines, who have got a thriving hub for this kind of electronic records. So a solution in a box is possible. For 144 hospitals and 2,000 clinics in the Ministry of Health, right, then a big decision will have to be made. Do you want to buy or build the system yourself? And if you buy, this massive third party will have to be contracted to build this for you, and then you buy the services from them, or you use the IT division inside Ministry of Health to build the system from scratch. This is a political decision, which is why recently there was a number that was bandied about, 1.5 billion ringgit, just to build the electronic health record system. We've actually been talking about this since the 1990s.
We have, yeah. And are we nowhere near seeing that become a reality?
I think we're making progress. But such an endeavour, even for a smallish country of 32 million people, even accounting the fact that we can be prospective and look forward rather than backward into the electronic records of the past, means that any progress will necessarily be slow. I'll give two more thoughts, if you allow me. The first one is Hospital Selayang was our first paperless hospital. Mm. And that was launched, I think, in the late 90s. And since then, we've not made progress with a second and a third and a fourth paperless hospital. So progress can be in fits and starts, you know, one step forward, two steps back. And the second thought that I might share is prospective versus retrospective. Now, I share this very freely with you, although I'm not an IT expert or a project management expert. There are machine reader, or rather optical character recognition software or OCR software that's available. Even adjusting for the terrible handwriting of all doctors, it might still be possible to scan the pages of health records, for example, and go as retrospective as you can. Assuming you don't want to do the retrospective, say, banking of the data, you can do prospective. Any new patient that comes in starts an electronic record, and over, say, a 5 or 10 year period, we would have enough data for us to build a good picture of that patient without having to go back to 1975.
Mm. And so, speaking of being prospective, we've come to the part of the show where I ask you to look into your crystal ball.
And my favorite part, Sherry.
I'm not sure you mean that. So, if looking ahead, what kind of system of service delivery would you like to see in the future to cater for things like, you know, new technologies and emerging healthcare needs of the future?
Mm. Well, I'll say a few things. This is an extremely broad question, so I get to narrow it down if you allow me. The first one is as much de-hospitalization and as much de-medicalization as we can. And I say this with all my conflicts of interest, that I'm a physician myself and I have an interest in non-hospital care. The more we have people in the community living lives that are healthy, the less dependent we are on hospitals, which are expensive and dangerous and very consuming in terms of our psyche and finances and politics, the better it is for us. So I envision a demedicalized and dehospitalized world. This is one. The second facet of the world that I imagine is actually so much prevention and primary care, and they're separate things. And perhaps in future conversations, we'll talk about what it means to be promoting healthcare and preventing diseases and also primary healthcare.
Mm-hmm.
The third view that I see in this world that we can accept new technologies to your specific question, it's actually a world where the citizens are involved. And when we talk about technology, one of the important elements of technology is not that it's the latest or the most expensive. These are important. But what I think about technology is that it's liberating. You can have wearables, for example, that communicate with you and the doctor. You can have teleconsultations, for example, primary care that you don't even have to get into a car and park a mile away to get to the hospital. Using technology that's inexpensive, that promotes autonomy and empowerment and allows you to control your health and also to be responsible for your health. I think that would be great.
Okay. Thank you very much, Swee King. That was Dr. Kaw Swee King, Public Policy Specialist. This has been our Health, the Nuts and Bolts series. On this episode, we were looking at hospitals as a key aspect of the delivery of healthcare services. You've been listening to Health and Living on The Bigger Picture, BFM 89.9.
Thank you for listening to this podcast. To find more great interviews, go to bfm.my or find us on iTunes. BFM 89.9, the business station.